The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from oprahmag.com. Okay, this first article is called Oprah Will Interview Meghan Markle and Prince Harry in a Primetime Special. It's been just over a year since Prince Harry and Meghan Markle first announced that they were going to step back from their royal duties in January of 2020. Since then, they've lived a quiet life in the United States with their one-year-old son, Archie. Now they're gearing up to talk about that decision, plus what life out of the public eye has been like in the year since. On March 7th, Oprah will sit down for a CBS Primetime special interview with the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. According to a press release from CBS, our O of O will speak with the couple in a wide-ranging interview that will begin with Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, about marriage, motherhood, and how she handled life under public pressure. The duo will then be joined by Prince Harry as the couple opens up about their move to the United States and their future hopes and dreams. Those hopes and dreams include expanding their family. On Valentine's Day, the same holiday his mother, Princess Diana, announced back in 1984 that she was pregnant with Prince Harry, the couple announced that they are expecting their second child. Oprah has a long-standing relationship with both Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, whom she shared in December also happened to be her neighbors in Santa Barbara, California. In 2019, Oprah announced she was teaming up with Apple and Prince Harry for a multi-part series that will focus on mental health and mental wellness, a project that is still in production. That same year, she also publicly defended Meghan Markle, telling Gayle King on CBS This Morning that she believed Markle was being treated unfairly by the press. She went on to say, "I feel that if people really knew her, they would know that she is not only everything you perceive her as being, graceful and dynamic in holding that position, but she just has a wonderful, warm, giving, funny heart. I see all the crazy press around her, and I think it's really unfair." Oprah with Meghan and Harry, a CBS Primetime special, will air on Sunday, March 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on CBS. If you don't have cable, you can watch online without cable through Hulu Live TV or YouTube TV. All right, this next article is called How You Can Join the Stop Asian Hate Movement. Asian American celebrities are weighing in on how you can help spread the word. Last June, while I frantically dashed through Costco to grab food for my family, I spotted an older Korean woman struggling to lift a pack of water bottles. I don't speak Korean, but I picked it up. I asked if she needed more. She pointed. I put the rest in her cart. She bowed and I smiled behind my mask. What I did wasn't extraordinary. But part of what has been ingrained in me as a child of Taiwanese immigrants is that elders deserve the utmost respect. Of course, you don't need to be Asian American to care for the elderly. But since the start of COVID-19, Asian seniors have disproportionately been the target of cruel verbal and physical attacks that have exponentially increased. According to Stop AAPI Hate, from March to December of 2020, 126 incidents were reported against Asian Americans over 60 years old. Unfortunately, Asian elders are easy targets. Most don't speak English. In New York City alone, 1 in 3 Asian seniors live in a limited English-speaking household, cannot defend themselves, and likely won't report what happened. When I first reported for this site about why the phrase Kung Flu was racist, I received Facebook comments arguing that the problematic term used to describe COVID-19 actually was not real racism. A few months later, I wrote about the alarming increase in attacks as the pandemic continued on. The current tally, as of February 2021, is at 2,808 firsthand accounts of anti-Asian hate from 47 states and the District of Columbia. A year later, I am mad. I can't look at videos of Asian seniors being beaten and assaulted. I am actually grateful that my grandmother is not alive right now. If she was, she could be pushed, shoved, and head cracked by someone who will not likely be charged with a hate crime. Under federal law, hate crimes must be a direct threat involving a weapon, like this person who threatened to kill Asian Americans on Lunar New Year. In the Asian American Pacific Islander community, many of us pride ourselves on saving face. We're taught to endure silently. But we can't do that any longer, especially in the wake of 61-year-old Noel Quintana, who was slashed with a box cutter on the New York subway, or a 91-year-old man who was pushed to the ground in Oakland's Chinatown, both in February. While the videos circulating are vital to document what's happening, for many Asian Americans like myself, seeing people who look like us attacked is taking a toll on our mental health. Lisa Sun, a psychology professor at Barnard College of Columbia University, says, "The only way to help each other cope with this violence and to address mental health is to speak out and to confide in others. We know that Asians put less weight on the individual self. But this translates into a true isolation." Among those speaking out are prominent Asian American celebrities who are lending their voices and platforms to spread awareness outside of the AAPI community. Daniel Dae Kim, Gemma Chan, Chrissy Teigen, Olivia Munn, and fashion designer Philip Lim have all been vocal, posting hashtag StopAsianHate Instagram post. On Instagram, Crazy Rich Asians leading man Henry Golding posted a discussion with writer Eric Toda about the anti-Asian violence. I reached out to Golding, who shared his sentiments. "The main goal needs to be to reach out to other communities for union, because spreading these stories between ourselves is just preaching to the choir." The star of the upcoming Marvel movie, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, and Canadian sitcom Kim's Convenience, retweeted photos of an assailant in Flushing, New York, who pushed an Asian woman into a pole. She required hospitalization and 10 stitches. In response to an email for this story, Lou commented, "For our allies, it's important to hear our words and not compare our struggles against those of other minority groups. We need everyone, not just Asian Americans, to recognize the severity of the issue and to take active steps in preventing it from happening anymore." There is a groundswell of grassroots efforts to help protect Asian elders. In Oakland, 26-year-old Jacob Azevedo was outraged at a disturbing video of an 84-year-old Thai man killed in San Francisco. He took to social media to volunteer to escort elderly Asians on outings so they wouldn't be harmed. Within days of his announcement, 400 volunteers came together to keep seniors safe in an effort called Compassion Oakland. In New York City, Asian American business owners joined the hashtag Enough is Enough fundraising campaign to provide free meals to the community, some of whom are afraid to venture out because of the ongoing violence. says Golding. It seems that the attacks are not covered thoroughly across the board, which leaves it to members of the public to spread the news via social media, like Daniel Day Kim and Daniel Wu, who have done great AAPI chats on Clubhouse. Recently, a hashtag #StopAsianHate Clubhouse talk featuring Daniel Day Kim, Daniel Wu, Lisa Ling, and Van Jones, among others, discussed what can be done to push this movement forward. During the Clubhouse chat, Dion Lim, a San Francisco TV reporter, said her email has been inundated with videos and anecdotes. 90% of these incidents never see the light of day. People are afraid and they're hindered by cultural barriers. Jones later added, I know a lot of Black people are ashamed and outraged about what's happening. You don't let this happen to people who are elderly and scared. At the government level, Assembly members Al Muratashvili and David Chu introduced Bill AB 557 on February 22nd to the California Department of Justice, requesting a toll-free hotline and online reporting system to allow victims and witnesses to anonymously report a hate incident. Every city needs to have a reach-out program that calls people directly in the Asian American community, says Sun. Since the need for anonymity is so strong, we need to set up anonymous hotlines. We need translators to ask questions and to get accurate reports of all racist acts. In a positive gesture, the California State Legislature approved $1.4 million in state funding toward research for organizations tracking the anti-Asian hate incidents, which awaits Governor Newsom's signature. Back in 2020, I could see the trajectory of what the Chinese virus and Kung Flu would bring to my community. As the year wore on, I collected more headlines, images of battered faces, and storefront signs that demanded we go back home, as if America is not meant for us. Go back to China is meant to silence our voices and put us in our place. We can do what we want to you here in America, said one misspelled racist sign placed on the door of a Japanese cookware store in California. Words have power, and I'm using every word that I've got. I hope you will, too. All right, this next article is called Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez Volunteers at Houston Food Bank Helps Raise More Than $4 Million. On Saturday, Representative AOC volunteered at the Houston Food Bank to help provide aid to Texas residents who have been affected by the recent devastating snowstorm which has impacted the area. AOC worked alongside Representative Sheila Jackson Lee and Sylvia Garcia to help pack boxes of food and supplies for those in need. Sharing footage from the food bank on Twitter, AOC wrote, We hit $3.2 million in Texas relief support last night. One of the places it's going is the Houston Food Bank. I'm visiting Representatives Jackson Lee, Texas 18, and La Congresista with volunteers to pack meals. The bank really needs helping hands. Can you join a shift? She then shared a link to the Houston Food Bank, encouraging volunteers to sign up to help. Later in the day, the fundraising efforts reached more than $4 million, and AOC tweeted, We just hit $4 million. Rep. Sylvia Garcia, Sheila Jackson Lee, and Al Green of Houston are doing incredible work with local relief organizations to get emergency relief to Texans. Today, we went to food distributions, water delivery sites, and home tours of impacted Texans. By Sunday night, she tweeted, One last update. I think we just hit $5 million raised for Texans across the state. Thank you all for your collective action when people need it most. Charity cannot replace policy, but solidarity is how we'll face climate change and build a better world. Earlier this week, President Joe Biden declared a major disaster as people across Texas have found themselves without electricity, food, and shelter in freezing temperatures, and deaths have sadly been caused. In a statement posted on Twitter, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said, "I thank President Biden for his assistance as we respond to impacts of winter weather from across our state. While this partial approval is an important first step, Texas will continue to work with our federal partners to ensure all eligible Texans have access to the relief they need." Okay, this next article is in the entertainment section, and it's called Mandy Moore Welcomes Her First Baby with Taylor Goldsmith, and her Instagram announcement is adorable. Mandy Moore is a mom. The This Is Us actress announced on Instagram today that she and her husband Taylor Goldsmith welcomed their first child together, a baby boy. They've named him August, but they'll call him Gus for short. "Gus is here," Mandy wrote on Instagram, along with a cute snapshot of her son. "Our sweet boy, August Harrison Goldsmith. He was punctual and arrived right on his due date, much to the delight of his parents. We were prepared to fall in love in all sorts of new ways, but this really goes beyond anything we could have ever imagined." Mandy has always been open about wanting kids someday, giving interviews where she talked candidly about trying to figure out the right timing with her successful career. "I'm not sure when," she said in a past interview. "Right now, my main focus and priority is my career, but that won't always be the case." When Mandy and Taylor did start trying for a baby, they ran into roadblocks. "Because of this issue with my uterus, I was very hesitant to believe it and put any stock in it," Mandy told Romper last month. "I was sort of holding my breath until 12 weeks. Once she was pregnant, she and Taylor took time to prepare themselves to be first-time parents. I think he's been suited to be a father for pretty much his whole life. He's been gearing up for this," she said. "Like in the morning, it's funny. I'll reach for my phone and he'll reach right for whatever baby book he's reading." She and Taylor announced her pregnancy back in September 2020, much to the delight of her fans. As for parenting itself, Mandy told Romper that she wants to raise an intelligent, feminist, loving, compassionate young man who respects women and who understands boundaries. Congrats to the happy couple. This next article is about the best relationship podcast. Relationships are like a living thing. They need to be nurtured in order to thrive, and poor care brings them to an early end. However long your bond lasts, the good news is that every relationship is a learning experience. And if you're dating, happily single but looking, getting over a breakup, or simply seeking tips on how to become a better partner in your marriage, one of the podcasts on this list will teach you something too. Esther Perel's Where Should We Begin lets listeners eavesdrop on others' relationship struggles. If you're in search of an expert opinion, pods like Savage Lovecast offer no-nonsense advice on how to get through every love and sex-related scenario imaginable. And if you desire deeply relatable takes from folks who have experienced what you're going through themselves, there are plenty of hilarious and entertaining options. Whatever your taste may be, you'll come away from any of these relationship podcasts a little bit wiser about what matters from the heart. And hopefully, your love life will be better for it. Where Should We Begin with Esther Perel? Mating in Captivity author Esther Perel may be one of the best-known couples therapists in the world, and listeners bear witness to her masterful skills on Where Should We Begin? In each episode, A different couple sits down to spill the details of their troubled relationship. As listeners, we get to learn something as we eavesdrop. In the Endless Honeymoon podcast, married comedians Moshe Kasher and Natasha Lidgero are ready to take your calls and spill your submitted secrets as they draw upon their own relationship experience to answer questions like, is it okay to booty call my ex? And should I let him go to Burning Man alone? A comedian-heavy roster of visitors join to advise. Often, they're other couples, such as 2021 guest Ronan Farrow and John Lovett. Modern Love. Anyone familiar with the New York Times long-running Modern Love column or the Amazon series it inspired will be a fan of this relaunched podcast, hosted by editors Daniel Jones and Maya Lee, and typically featuring celebrity narrators. You'll find quirky stories about love in all forms. They're often followed by a chat with the author about what's happened since. Dear Sugars, for years, an anonymous person named Sugar eventually revealed to be wild author Cheryl Strayed doled out gorgeously written advice in a wildly popular rumpus column. Now it's a podcast, hosted by Strayed and original Dear Sugar columnist Steve Almond. While not every episode deals with romantic love, the soothing listen invites us all to approach each other with a little more empathy and care. On the Savage Lovecast, we hear from Dan Savage. If you're familiar with the abbreviations GGG, DTMFA, and CPOS, you're likely a Dan Savage fan already. Each weekly episode features a celebrity or an expert guest and finds Savage answering love and sex-related questions with the signature brand of no-nonsense counsel that made him, as he says, America's only advice columnist. The I Do podcast. Chase and Sarah Kosterlitz have been married for over 10 years, and their I Do podcast aims to give young couples the tools to have the best union possible. Their interview format pod welcomes a different expert each week, and with nearly 300 episodes under their belt, they've likely addressed an issue you may be grappling with. Love Letters. This podcast from the Boston Globe advice columnist Meredith Goldstein has a theme every season. Season 4's is Love at Any Age, while season 3's was How Do You Know? Each episode is loosely related to that theme, offering a well-told love story that may inspire you to keep your own heart open. Couples therapy. Relationships aren't the sole topic in this delightful celebrity interview show from married comedians Naomi Ekperigin and Andy Beckerman, or Jubu, as she calls him. But they regularly answer listeners' relationship-related advice questions and often welcome another couple as guests, such as author Glennon Doyle and soccer player Abby Wambach. Paired by the people. If you've ever fancied yourself a matchmaker or you love a good setup story, Paired by the People is for you. In the age of data-driven dating apps, host Lakshmi is dedicated to reviving the art of the setup in real life. The pod's concept? Two people debate about which two of their friends they should set up and why. Then you get to listen in on the date itself. Dateable. Self-described Sherpas, Julie and you, have a bottomless appetite for all things relationship-related, and every week they welcome a guest, such as How Not to Die Alone, author, and data science guru Logan Urey to offer valuable advice for those wondering whether they're undateable. Spoiler alert, you're not. Talking It Out with Mike and Brian. Fans of the Bachelor franchise will recognize popular former contestant Mike Johnson and his co-host Brian, who tied the knot with Bachelorette Rachel Lindsay after winning her love in season 13. Talking their way through topics like initiate sex, set expectations, and more ways to maintain a relationship and career, Johnson and Abalasso offer something that's still too rare in the relationship media landscape. Two heterosexual men who are intent on improving their communication skills and want to help others who'd like to as well. Black Love Matters. Longtime couples may hear a bit of themselves in the banter from host Niram and Niambi, who sit down for frank and funny conversations about black love and how they keep their own relationship healthy. They also answer listeners' questions and share their takes on the pop culture they're loving and not loving. Dating Straight. Listening to Amy Ordman and Jack Dodge's Dating Straight feels like joining a hangout session with two of your funniest gay friends. While they don't pretend to have all the answers, they often welcome guests that might, and their banter will keep you laughing through the highs and lows of your own love life. Multiamory. Multiamory covers all facets of non-monogamy, from open marriage to polyamorous bonds, in a quest to help others navigate them. Or just learn if they're interested. Host Emily, Jace, and Dedecker bring curiosity and a respectful tone to explore topics that are often misunderstood. Sex with Emily. Though Emily Morse has a PhD in human sexuality, Sex with Emily covers issues both in and out of the bedroom, which isn't surprising since she's been doing the podcast since 2005. Dr. Emily's highly educational pod is a bottomless resource of advice and tips on all things pleasure-related. Dyking Out. As you may have guessed by the irreverent title, Dyking Out is centered around queer culture. Each week, lesbian comedians Carolyn Berger and Melody Kamali welcome a guest to discuss a facet of LGBTQIA culture, from pansexuality to the lesbian film classic, But I'm a Cheerleader. This next article is called Barack Obama and Bruce Springsteen Have a New Podcast. The first two episodes are out now on Spotify. The friendship between former President Barack Obama and Bruce Springsteen is well documented. They are vacation buddies after all, and now the two have joined forces for a new podcast, Renegades. Born in the USA, debuted exclusively on Spotify on February 22nd, with its first two episodes coming out jointly. The show itself is culled from long conversations the two had over several days at Springsteen's farmhouse. It takes its name from Springsteen's 1984 single and 15 times platinum album, Born in the USA. In the series premiere, the pair specifically discuss how their friendship was forged and the commonalities of life as an artist and a politician. In the same way that a musician is looking for a way to channel and work through the pain, demons, personal questions, that was certainly true for me in terms of getting into public life, Obama explained. Obama and Springsteen have known each other for over a decade. Their relationship was brought into the spotlight in November 2016 when Obama awarded the legendary musician the Medal of Freedom. I am the president, he is the boss, Obama joked, alluding to Springsteen's long-standing nickname. pushing 70, he's still laying down four-hour live sets. If you haven't been at them, he is working, making fire-breathing rock and roll. Springsteen also played a concert in honor of Obama at the White House in January of 2017. He helped campaign for the two-term president, including a comedic track he performed in Ohio in 2012 during Obama's re-election bid. In the second episode titled American Skin, Race in the United States, the pair swap stories about witnessing and, in Obama's case, experiencing racism. The legacy of race is buried, but it's always there. Depending on the community you're in, how far near the surface it is not always clear. A lot of Black folks always talk about how what's hardest is not dealing with a Klansman. What cuts people is the people you know are not bad people, and the fact that that card is still in their pocket, that at some unexpected moment it might be played, is heartbreaking. Renegades is the latest entry into the Obama family's foray into the podcasting world. Last summer, Michelle Obama podcast launched with the former First Lady both sharing stories from her own life and having conversations with writer Michelle Norris, Conan O'Brien, and her own mother and brother. His wife's experience podcasting was part of what inspired President Obama to try his hand at it. Since leaving the White House, the Obamas have launched Higher Ground Productions in 2018 and have produced several acclaimed documentaries, including Becoming and the Academy Award-nominated American Factory, which focuses on a Chinese company opening up a production plant in small-town Ohio. Six additional Renegades episodes will be released in the coming weeks. All right, this next article is called Deja and Reagan Bernard of Buried by the Bernards on Growing Up in a Funeral Home. One of the most delightful shows of 2021 so far is a reality TV show about a funeral home. Yes, you heard that right. Out on February 12th, Netflix's Buried by the Bernards is a heartwarming profile of the Bernard family, owners of R. Bernard Funeral Services in Memphis, Tennessee. When you think of reality TV, you usually think of drama. We're not like that, said Deja Bernard. She's the family's 25-year-old eldest daughter. Even though it was a huge blessing to get this show, it doesn't take away from us. We're still the same loving Bernard family. When families come in, we're still going to love you and cherish you. Nothing is going to change. Deja and her younger sister, Reagan, assist with the funeral business, which their father, Ryan Bernard, founded in 2017. Their sister's grandmother, Debbie, calls herself the big boss. She clashes with her son over that. Kevin Miller, Ryan's uncle, is the show's undeniable comedic star. Perhaps unsurprisingly, given their boundless charm, Buried by the Bernards is not the family's first time in the spotlight. 3 weeks after the funeral home opened its doors, one of its commercials went viral, thanks to the unexpectedly humorous commercial in which Miller pops out of a casket upon hearing of the funeral home's prices. The Bernards were spotlighted on a Steve Harvey Show segment, which eventually led to this reality series. We're a funeral home business. Nobody expects a commercial to be funny. The unexpectedness is what made it go viral, Reagan, age 18, says, reflecting on the commercial that put them on the map. Located in a former bank, the R. Bernard Funeral Home also made headlines for its drive-in viewing window. Once designated for a bank teller, the window now displays bodies in coffins. Deja said everyone made a joke about that feature, but really it's allowed the business to thrive in the pandemic's difficult times. The series was filmed from 2019 through 2020 before, in a grim twist, business began to boom due to the coronavirus pandemic. With large gatherings like funerals banned in Memphis, the funeral home's drive-through windows gives families a chance to say goodbye to their loved ones. Now everyone is able to use the drive-through window and practice social distancing while still being together, Deja says, adding that other local funeral businesses are leasing out the feature. That drive-through window has come in handy. I hate it so much, but we're getting business because of it. A year after filming wrapped, Deja and Reagan continue to work for the funeral home while following their individual dreams and working on their pound cake business. Reagan is now pursuing a degree in nursing at the University of Memphis. In the spring, Deja is returning to school to pursue a degree in journalism, in addition to getting her funeral director license, all while juggling raising two daughters with her boyfriend. As close as they are, Deja and Reagan spent their childhoods without knowing each other. Ryan, who had Reagan with another woman, first learned of Deja's existence when she was 15. Reagan was in fourth grade when her mom called her to tell her that she had an older sister. "I screamed. I had always wanted a sister." Reagan, who has an older brother, says, "When I got that call, I just about passed out." For Deja, meeting Reagan was like meeting a twin. She was delighted to learn that they were supposed to have the same birth date. Reagan was born a few days early, but they're both Pisces. "We are the same person. Sometimes we would finish each other's sentences like real twins. She'll come to work and say, 'Check out this book.' And I'll say, 'Reagan, I'm already reading it.'" The sisters say growing up surrounded by death has given them an appreciation for the preciousness and fragility of life. "Your life can change in an instant." "It's changed my perspective on reality," Reagan says. Deja says her job has rendered her an extremely vigilant mother. "I'm extra careful with my babies. I have to monitor where they're going. I'm not just letting anyone babysit them. You cannot imagine how many young people we see." As much as their job brings them grief, it brings them comfort too. "What helps me cope is being able to be there for the families," Deja says. "I'm going to treat your family member like they're my family member." At their best, Deja says, funerals are celebrations of life. She recalls one that felt more like a family reunion. They were dancing around and having fun. "For a minute, you felt like you weren't at a funeral," she says. Deja foresees her daughters, Ava and Alani, taking over the business one day. "We're just going to keep passing it down the generations," she says. "And maybe one day they'll impress their friends by driving home from school in a hearse, just like their Aunt Reagan." The Bernard sisters are partners for life, and it's all thanks to their father's leap to start R. Bernard Funeral Services 5 years ago. "My dad is very proud. He's like, 'This is my family legacy. This is something I created.'" It's a proud dad moment for him, Deja says. All right, here's an article called "Award-Winning Author George Saunders' New Book on Writing Unlocks the Magic of Short Fiction." On some special Sundays, we offer readers Sunday Shorts, original stories by the best short fiction stylist of our time. But today, instead of a new story, we're celebrating one of the masters of the craft, George Saunders, and his ode to the form, "A Swim in the Pond in the Rain." What follows is a review of the book by Hamilton Kane, and then an interview with the author. The great Russian authors of the 19th century paved the way for our own modernity, their creative fires stoked by the inequalities of classism, imperial oppression, and the conundrums of love and morality. Yet who hasn't felt a twinge of intimidation when approaching Tolstoy and Chekhov? Why bother climbing Olympus? Fear not. The eminent short story writer and Booker Prize winner George Saunders comes to the rescue with A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, an enthralling, clear-eyed, between-the-covers seminar on 7 classic Russian stories and what they reveal about the form and about human nature. For over 2 decades, Saunders has been teaching these stories to students at the Syracuse University, breaking them down page by page, even paragraph by paragraph, to distill each master's technique, how the layers, Saunders calls them blocks, shape up and relate to one another. And he acknowledges the form's unique power to pose and answer the big questions, like, how are we supposed to be living down here? What are we put here to accomplish? What should we value? What is truth? For example, through a pattern of repetition and variation, Chekhov's The Darling teases out the loneliness of a middle-aged woman. Turgenev's The Singers offers up a surfeit of details and asides about drunken peasants in an inn, only to braid everything together on the final page. Tolstoy's Alyosha the Pot highlights the shifting political winds in the late Tsarist Russia by elevating a simpleton as a real person with real struggles and an innate humanity. To review, a story is a linear temporal phenomenon, Saunders observes, a series of incremental pulses, each of which does something to us. There are razor-sharp critiques here, but also rich personal history. What's most striking about the book is Saunders' conversational, even intimate tone. We're getting a masterclass in how to read and write fiction. A Midwestern baby boomer, Saunders writes candidly about his training as an engineer, his passion for music, his love of wife and daughters, all tributaries that feed his craft. He notes how he hammered out story after story in a Hemingway-esque mode, realist, tightly structured, only to rack up rejections from journals. But then, by accident, he backed into a voice that sounded like no other, one that captured his slapstick humor and was eventually published in his debut collection, Civil War Land in Bad Decline. The story was oddly made, slightly embarrassing. It exposed my actual taste, which it turned out was kind of working class and raunchy and attention-seeking. Bingo. And perhaps that's how A Swim in a Pond in the Rain shines brightest. By picking his way through these 7 tales, Saunders rejuvenates his craft, not only as an author, but as a teacher. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Chekhov, Gogol, and Tolstoy, long dead, still live and breathe each time he sits down at the keyboard, his idealized self facing off against the flawed man. I find this happening all the time. I like the person I am in my stories better than I like the real me. That person is smarter, wittier, more patient, funnier. His view of the world is wiser, he says. When I stop writing and come back to myself, I feel more limited and opinionated and petty. But what a pleasure it was to have been on the page, briefly less a dope than usual. All right, and now I'm going to read the interview. It's actually a conversation between Lee Haber and George Saunders. You write that you want your own stories to move and change someone as much as these Russian stories have moved and changed me. What are some of the ways those stories have moved and changed you? He says, I'd say the main thing is that every time I read one, my relation to the world gets altered. or, you know, micro-altered. I come out of them wanting to be a better person. I love the world more and feel a greater sense of belonging. Feel more strongly that I have responsibilities in this world that I may not be living up to, which is exciting. It means that stuff matters, which makes life more fun. And Lee asked, what makes the short story form particularly suited to having this effect? And George says, I'm not sure. I know that this group of stories and a bunch of others written by Russians in this particular time frame have this effect more strongly on me than do most others. And I think that's because they understood that the function of art is to make us look around and wonder, and maybe feel discontent at the way human beings, including ourselves, behave. But any good story is, I think, going to be felt as a moral, ethical document. Why? I think it's built into the form. If I say, once upon a time, and you look up and you see that my story is, say, 8 pages long, the implication, the implicit promise, is something big is going to happen, and it's going to happen fast, and it's going to matter, and it's going to be non-trivial. That is, the form promises urgency. It also promises change. The first part of a story presents some kind of stasis. Things had always been this way. The presence of additional pages means the stasis is about to get disrupted. So, change is going to happen. And when a static situation changes, that makes meaning. If, on pages 1 to 2, Jim has never had a pet and hates pets and swears he will continue to never have a pet, we know he's going to get a pet. What we don't know is why. Something has to change in Jim, or happen to Jim. And that is going to amount to a small moral manifesto if Jim's life is saved by a dog. And Jim then comes across an orphan dog that looks like the one who saved him. That's saying one thing about life. If Jim steals from work, and his boss says he won't call the cops as long as Jim adopts his terrible, dysfunctional 200-pound Rottweiler, that's saying something different about life. But the meaning comes directly from the change. Lee asks, you write that the Russians you started reading saw fiction as a vital, moral, ethical tool, which is how you felt. Can you elaborate? He says, I came to fiction late and from a strange angle. I wasn't a big reader in high school, but what I read were the books that seemed to want me to help me learn how to live, that tended to moralize. Ayn Rand, Robert Persig, Khalil Gibran, etc. I loved being alive and wanted to make the best of it. But I was also, deep inside, insecure and struggling. And I found the idea of having a life philosophy exciting, but real philosophy struck me as too hard. On the advice of a teacher whom I'd ask, who was the smartest person who ever lived? I tried to read Goethe, but I couldn't make any sense of it. I think I was looking for what I'd call a philosophy of easy triumph, a somewhat didactic book that I'd find I agreed with and would then use to harshly judge all of the other kids at college who were getting far better grades with much less effort and going to Europe next summer, whereas I was going to work on a landscaping crew in Texas for minimum wage. The basic idea being that there might be something wrong with you, but with enough study of the right books, you can find that there's actually something wrong with them. All of them. So when I read contemporary American fiction, other than Hemingway, it felt too lunkheaded to me, too nuanced and contemporary. Because I was also a bit of a prig, didn't drink, was fond of lecturing people on Ayn Rand concepts of dignity and eternal dominance of the egotistical doer and so on. But somehow the Russians, they were like a gateway drug. They were talking about how to live, but they seemed more realistic and lifelike with flesh on their bones. They took up the big questions, but then set about answering them in normal-sized human beings. No supermen or moral exemplars, etc. I felt the authenticity and sincerity in them. I also have a suspicion that I am a reincarnated 19th century Russian. Lee asks, how does a short story help supply answers to questions like, how are we supposed to be living down here, or help us recognize truth? George says, I think the main way is by painting the character into a corner that we ourselves have been in, or can easily imagine ourselves being in, perhaps in slightly exaggerated form. So we feel at one with that character, or we come to feel that way over the course of the story. At the beginning, we're apart from the character and slightly above her. As our head gets filled up with specific facts about her, and as we come to see ourselves as like her, we move closer to her, and she rises until in a perfect story, we become one. She is us, and we are her. We are equals, united by fondness. And this is true even if the character is bad or doing some questionable things. We maybe don't and shouldn't like that character, but we see her more clearly. We have more data on her. And this is a pretty good aspiration for real life. We see someone and they are at first the other, lower than us and less interesting. But we can, by leaning in and being curious, come to see that person as just us on a different day. So what starts out as an artistic enterprise is seen to be at least potentially a spiritual enterprise as well. When you think about it, when we wake up in the morning, we're pretty much blank. Right away, information just starts flooding in. Some of that comes from the world itself. We see a bird, a storm is moving in. The summer air smells wonderful. Our partner tells us that she slept great and had a dream about her first grade teacher. And some of it comes from other places. The radio, the TV, and increasingly these days, and I say this as a person who checks his phone when he gets up at 3 a.m. to pee, from the internet. It makes sense, I think, for us to ask, of any information that is trying to penetrate that sacred kingdom called our mind, where did you come from and how were you made? What basic assumptions are behind you? The tweet blushes and answers, well, a thought came into this guy's mind, and he blurted it out with the intention of calling attention to himself, come hell or high water. Also, we only allowed him 140 characters because, that's, you know, our brand, Facebook says. We give you a chance to performatively control others' perception of your life. Just don't be dull or go on too long, and no unfortunate but truthful photos, please, and so on. So we're being bombarded with information that is laced with someone else's agenda, and that mode of expression has come to dominate. Compare this with prose written in a literary mode. There is absolute freedom. A person not only can but should revise the piece over many months of years, and every time the piece is going to get smarter and more nuanced and wittier. This is strange but true, and more filled with compassion and sympathy. And yes, I would say love. And the aim of that piece of writing is communication. The writer is trying to communicate something of what she's learned about life to a reader she views as her equal. It's exploratory, ambiguity embracing. It's happy to confound and resistant to facile judgment. So, in spite of the above, I have nothing against social media, but I think our reading diet is too rich with it and too poor in literary prose. Prose that opens us up and makes us less agitated and combative. Instead of more, we've somehow, many of us, come to treat literary stories and novels as some sort of freaky side dish. But I'd say that storytelling is the essential human activity. We're doing it literally 24 hours a day. Even in something as simple as, the freeway is going to be jammed at this time of day. I'd better take the side streets. And certainly when we think, I wonder if Mary realizes how much she hurts my feelings. Or, I can't stand those, insert the name of the opposing political party. This is all projection. Making up stories when we don't have all the facts. Fiction trains us in certain ways of doing this better, more fairly, and with certain necessary doubts seeded in. We learn the value, for example, of specificity, to look for the specific and eschew the generality, and so on. As for truth, when we read a piece of fiction which we know to be invented, we can feel ourselves pulled in by the actual. That is, moments when we go, oh yes, it is like that for sure. So this might be seen as a practice of sharpening our truth detectors. A story, a good story, is a series of true observations. And gradually a story is formed. If we know what we want to do or say, and then we do or say that, everyone is bummed out. Art is supposed to surprise itself. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.